Good morning. It's time for the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
And good morning. I'm Dave Kvickin.
Good morning. I'm Dan Glasser.
Dan and I are two of the attorneys at the Herzog Law Firm. We're here every weekend talking about things like estate planning and long-term care planning, wills, trusts, powers of attorney, real estate, when we're lucky to have Dan Glasser with us. We have offices in Albany, Saratoga Springs, Clifton Park, and down in Kingston. And we'd love to hear your questions or comments at 416-476-5900. I almost gave out our office line, which I'll give out later, just to not confuse people again, 518-476-5900. Dan, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Dave. I'm so great. Living the dream. It is a beautiful day. The sun is shining. And we're almost halfway through May already.
Indeed it is. And you have a number of children. I assume today is chock full of activities.
Today is chock full of soccer, more soccer, and gymnastics, and some fundraising activities for soccer.
Wow.
So it's jam-packed, but I love it. How are you doing, Dave?
I'm good. I was going to say you wouldn't have it any other way. I'm doing well. I'm doing good as well. Jackie has her first lacrosse game, and I don't know how 7-year-olds actually play lacrosse. I don't know if the actions of throwing and catching work out very well, but
okay.
We'll see what happens, and can't wait. Super excited. She's super excited. Isabel played in college, so it's pretty great that her daughter is learning lacrosse. So we're pretty excited.
Ah, nice.
Yeah. So I know we're going to talk about a whole lot of estate planning, but on the drive over to the Albany office this morning, I heard a fantastic song by Paul Simon. I won't get into it, but it made me think about working for my parents. They were dentists. I would work in their office, and they would listen to an oldie station and called CBS FM down in the city. And I, fell in love with all these different kinds of music. I really super love music and so on. And I thought, well, wait a minute. I'm on with Dan. We do have Ben Patton running the show here. I want to know when you guys really got into music. Dan, I know you really like Taylor Swift, for example. Ben, I did my research. This is true, Ben. So I did my research before, and it says, Ben, you've been hosting the show in one form or another since 2001, 20 years.
That's correct. In November 5th of 2021, it'll be 20 years, Magic in the Morning Show. Yep.
And it's, fantastic music you guys have been playing.
Thank you.
Throughout the time. And so that would kind of be my dream come true. So how'd you get, sorry to make it about you, but I want to make it about you. How'd you fall in love with us?
Well, it's funny that you ask me that because it started when I was like 10 or 11 years old. I would sit in the living room of my house and I would listen to the radio and I would create commercials for jewelry stores and things like that and listen to the music. But it was really when I was like 16 or 17, I won a contest and I got to go to a station in Middletown, Connecticut called WCNX. And the person that was there was Jason McCarter. I'll never forget it because he let me go into this production studio. Back then we played records. And he let me sit there and fool around, just put the records on and play them and hear how it sounds going from one to another. I was hooked. And it just continued from there. So, it was a long time ago. And I love, just about all types of music. So, but the stuff that we play is, is my favorite. So it certainly is a pleasure for me to be able to do that.
That is so cool. I was getting goosebumps. Dan, how about you? Were you getting goosebumps?
I sure was. Yep, they are. There they are.
How about yourself, Dan?
So I first started getting into music when I was a teen. The first CD that I got was Live, their Throwing Copper album. I was playing a lot of ice hockey at the time, and music got me pumped up, and I just started getting more and more into it. And, you know, music is amazing. It's therapy, it's motivation, it's relatable. And then I started listening to Green Day and The Offspring. Perhaps that's why I have six kids. And then about 11 years or so ago, my wife got me a Taylor Swift album, and then that's pretty much all I listen to right now. You know, she's a great artist.
Awesome. And to kind of make it full circle here, what then got me thinking even more about all this stuff, and I appreciate the listeners kind of listening to us not talk about what we're supposed to be talking about here. But we have a theme song, right? Then When I'm 64 is our song. And
that's our song. That's right.
It's our song from the album Fill in the Blank, Ben. What album is that from?
Rubber Soul?
No, Sgt. Pepper.
Okay.
Came out
I'm taking a call for you guys. Hang on.
Oh.
Oh, wow.
Continue talking, but I'll be right back.
Yeah. Oh, no problem. Oh, no problem. So, Dan, it came out 1967, the song When I'm 64. It's from the album by the Beatles called Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. The life expectancy, Dan, when that song came out, When I'm 64, was a full 10 years less than what the current life expectancy is in our country. And I just thought it was super interesting because when they came out with the song saying When I'm 64 meant you were about 5 years from the average person passing away. And I don't think anyone who is 64 right now feels that way, or certainly not most people. And it's just amazing how life can change. You know, 50, 60 years later, there's a full decade more that we have our loved ones with us, and it kind of makes it that much more important to plan for getting even older, right? When for us, when I'm 64, it's a great age to talk about because you're just entering the part of your life where it's really important to plan for long-term care needs. You might not have long-term care needs yet, but, you know, 5-10 years later, it might be a different story, and the percentages change. And so, you know, part of this show and part of what we do is to get people out there to plan ahead of time and know their options. And it's fun when music plays a role in it. So pretty cool stuff, Dan.
Dave, very Dan, cool. We have our first caller of the day. And I was just talking about this guy a couple of weeks ago. And Dave, I don't know if you were on, because I think we're off air when I was talking about it. But this is a blast from the past. It's Larry from Atlanta.
Larry from Atlanta.
Yep, Larry from Atlanta. Larry?
Hi, Larry. Sorry, Brian. Good morning, guys. Hi. Brian, you made me laugh. How are you, sir?
Good. How's it going?
Going good. Listen, I've got a question for you. I need your always good advice. And let me say, I think that the people at Herzog walk on water. You guys are wonderful, truly.
Thank you.
My situation is I'm working on developing all my estate documents. I have a number of firearms, and someone told me that it's wise to have what's, I guess, called a gun trust, a firearm trust, so that when I pass, it'll be easier for my executor to deal with those firearms. I want to get your opinion about that and maybe get any good advice on how I should prepare or have someone prepare a firearm trust.
Well, that's a fantastic call, and good to hear from you, Larry. So,
thank you.
A number of years ago, we actually had a mini seminar. I think we called it Let's Talk, and it was about what to do with firearms. And you know, this isn't New York City. You know, this isn't the suburbs. Up here, it's very normal for people, either for hunting or other, to have firearms. And it, just like everything else, it's super important to plan ahead of time for them.
you know, if it's a registered firearm, there's a whole procedure for what happens when someone passes away. They want to keep track of these firearms, as you know, obviously that makes a lot of sense. Hunting guns are treated a little differently than non-hunting guns. Obviously, old guns are treated differently as well. I have not really done any gun trusts myself, Larry, but I know that we've done many of them at the firm. And sometimes it's just language in a will or in a trust talking about the firearms. You're still going to need to go through the local police department to get the firearms changed over the way you want. But just like any other piece of, you know, personal property, an important personal property, value or otherwise, you need to have an idea of where you want it to go. If you say everything goes to my issue and my trust, everything goes to my kids, well, I don't know if my daughter is going to want that. I don't know if my son's going to want that. I don't know. Maybe I meant for a certain family member, my nephew, to get those guns because he likes them. So planning ahead of time always makes a lot of sense. I don't have a lot to talk about when it comes to gun trust, but we do have lots of materials on them. We do have a seminar that we've done before. I'm happy to share the slides with you.
Fantastic, my friend. Thank you. How would I get those slides? Or do you guys have a podcast on this online that I can listen to?
We don't have a podcast. This is the closest thing we have to these in our webinars. But what we can do is we can have you email us at info@herzoglaw.com, and that way we can get you those materials.
Thank you so much. Listen, Brother Ben, God bless you and God bless your family. Thank you so much. Y'all take care.
Take care.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks so much for the call, Eric. Dan, you know, we were talking right before here about, you know, changes over time and what happens when we create a trust as we're getting older. You know, lifespans are changing, all that stuff. The real estate world is changing. You are a real estate attorney, and I think it's our duty to talk a lot about real estate right now for you to let everyone know how real estate's changed and what to do if they're thinking about selling their home.
That is correct, Dave. So the real estate market is very busy. The rates are low. They have creeped up slightly, but still, they're historically at fantastic rates. So if you are thinking about selling, you need to understand that your house, if it is priced right, will not stay on the market that long. So you'll want to start thinking about stuff like where you're going to go. If you want to move to another house, if you're going to move into an apartment, you want to make sure all those things are lined up. I do recommend that sellers get it's called a pre-listing inspection, have an inspector go to the house and check for any defects. A lot of seller or homeowners, I should say, don't go into their attic every week to check for mold. I know I don't. I don't know if you do, Dave or Ben. There could be issues with the home that the seller doesn't know about. So if they do find out, they can take care of them and avoid that delay if it did come up under a contract. I also recommend title searches be done. Yes, a title search is done during the transaction, but sometimes there are cases where there's a glitch. There's an open mortgage or a judgment from a prior owner, and that can chew up at least a month in trying to get it fixed. So if you do find out about it ahead of time, we can start working on clearing the issue and avoid any unnecessary delays. Yes, it does cost a few hundred dollars to do a title search, but it is well worth it when compared to the time that you'll save if you're under contract to sell.
Dan, let's roll that back for a second because I know some of our listeners are going to hear get a title search done, it's no big deal, right? I know what a title search means. Well, maybe they don't know what it means. So overall, the concept, I like conceptual stuff. when you're buying something, when you're selling a piece of property, you want to know that the person selling it actually owns it. You want to know that you're not going to owe money to some other creditor or some other lien holder when you start buying this property. You kind of want to know the lay of the land. So when you're selling, you're saying sometimes it's a good idea to not only get a physical inspection of the home to know what problems may come up as you're trying to sell it, but to get a title search updated. Number one, saves time if there's an issue. And the idea is someone would be going, I assume, to the county to figure out, are there any liens on this piece of property? Who is the rightful owner? And so on. And you're saying that speeds up the process.
Correct. Yeah, so we would, there's a person that goes out to the county clerk's office where the property is located, and they check what's called the chain of title. So Dave sold 123 Main Street to Dan, and then Dan sold it to Ben, and then Ben sold it to Taylor. So we follow this chain to make sure that the correct legal description was in every deed. We want to make sure that the deed was signed and notarized. If there was a person in the chain of title years ago that we don't see ever signed off on the deed, that's a problem. We can't assume that they're deceased. We would need proof of that. Mm-hmm. So this comes up, when we have life estate. People reserve the right to use property during their natural life. And in order to convey clear title, that person, if they are still alive, would need to sign the deed, or the title company would require proof of death.
So, Dan, on that point, so I actually was going to bring up life estates later on. I'm so happy you did now. So I'd like to break down what this is, because we don't normally talk about life estates on the radio, but it's a really fantastic tool out there to accomplish a lot of the goals our clients have, and it comes without, the cost necessarily of doing a trust. There's downsides to it. So why don't we explore what a life estate is, and then we'll kind of get into what it means for a real estate attorney. So, Dan, you and your wife own a house, right?
We do.
So the way you own it is you actually own it until the end of time. I don't know if you knew that. You own your house until the end of time.
Wow. I never thought of it that way, but...
Yeah. Unless you decide to sell your home, then you will not own it until the end of time. But this form of title that you guys have, right, it's fee title. It's forever. And that's really important, because if I want to buy your house and I'm going to get a loan to buy your house, not only do I, the buyer, but or my bank, the lender, want to make sure I'm buying the whole house forever and ever, they want to know that later on, if they need to sell the house, if I want to sell the house, I can also, right, it's kind of like an attribute of the property to own it forever and ever. Now, we know you're not going to live forever and ever, or I'm not going to live forever and ever. So we know at some point the new owner of the property will end up being our estate, right? And that's where we get into lots of complicated things like probate and estate administration, because we need someone who's not alive to be the signatory for this estate for someone who passed away, okay? A life estate deed is where we kind of break up now until forever. And what we do is we say, hey, Dan, I'm going to give you my home, so you get the forever part, but I'm going to retain something called a life estate. I'm going to keep the here and now. Now until my death, that's me. I'm going to pay all the bills. I'm going to live there. I'm going to enjoy the heck out of that home. Upon my death, right, once, Dan, you have a death certificate for me, you are the only owner of the property. You had it today, but it was subject to the rest of my life. So it's called a life estate. How are we doing, Dan?
We're doing great. You know, when you said here and now, that reminded me of our discussion about music, and it just got me thinking about Luther Vandross. It's a great song.
Here and now. I will use different words next time to avoid that.
As you were.
So when you do a life estate deed, guess what? It avoids probate for your home, because technically I don't own my home anymore. Technically Dan owns my home. subject to my life use, right? So it's great to avoid probate. You keep your STAR exemptions and your veterans exemptions and other tax deductions and abatements. Why? Because you, the person, I, in this situation, am still responsible for everything, and I have something called exclusive use and occupancy of the property. So, great, we're avoiding probate, we're keeping our current benefits. We even can start the clock on these look-back periods for long-term care, Dan, because I, by myself, can no longer sell that home, right? If we wanted to sell the home to Ben, or you wanted to sell the home to Ben, I need to agree, right? He needs my signature on that, and that's what you were talking about. If I died, you would need proof of death. But if I'm still alive, I need to agree. So,
correct.
Because of that, Medicaid doesn't count it, or, 5 years later, it's something that starts to look back period. Those are the positives, right? And it costs, less than doing a trust. And I know, Dan, that there's a bunch of people who listen to our show who are our clients who are going to say to themselves, they're going to say, wait a minute. I have a trust, and you're telling me I could have done a life estate deed and gotten all the same benefits? No, that's not what we're saying, because there are a lot of negatives that come with that life estate deed from a planning perspective. Sounds great to avoid probate, right? Sounds great to get the clock ticking on Medicaid, but guess what? Me, the person, I still have a lot of life left, all right? I just turned 64, right? And not back in Sergeant Pepper days when I'm 64. I turned 64 in 2021. I got decades in front of me. So as I'm planning for long-term care, I can't do a life estate deed, because what if I want to move? You mean I got to get my kids to sign a deed so that I can actually sell my own home? Those are some of the negatives that come with the life estate deed, Dan. And from a long-term care perspective, those are huge, because when I give the house to Dan today and I keep this life use, this life estate, until my death, if we do sell it, Dan, if we sell it to Ben, we're going to sell it to Ben for $1 million. Who owns the house? You, Dan, will own more than I do, because forever is a lot longer than the rest of my life. And what happens is that from the proceeds of the sale, you're going to get a lot more money than I do. Which was not my intent. I want my money forever and ever. I want to be able to control everything. And that is what makes it so important that people do trust. Life estates are options. Typically, they're options for people that only have a home. They're never, ever going to move. There's no money to protect aside from the home. The ability to sell a piece of property is one of the most important attributes to owning property. It sounds weird. Like when you buy your home, right, Dan, you're kind of doing title searches to make sure that you could sell your home one day. And it oftentimes doesn't make sense. But in reality, that's what we're talking about. On the real estate side, you want to be able to move that asset, buy another asset, downsize, upsize. From an estate perspective, we want the same flexibility to be able to continue to protect money, because if we do move into one of those senior apartments and I do sell my home for $350,000, I got to make sure that money's protected from a Medicaid standpoint, right? You want to make sure I'm going to get that money, that closing's going to happen. I want to make sure not only does that happen, but we're still protecting the money. So it's where our worlds meet, Dan.
They sure do, Dave. That was well said.
So I apologize for going on a tangent here, but you did say life estate, and I wanted to get into it. But do you mind getting back into all those different things you were talking about, preparing to maybe sell your house this year, next year? What you said a physical inspection. You said maybe title searches. What else?
Planning. Have a place to go. I've got some clients right now that they want to sell just because of the market we're in. They have no place to go, so they're going to go crash with their family for a few months, or at least what they think is a few months. A lot of people are looking into new construction now to save money, which isn't really how it's going to work out, because the cost of building materials has skyrocketed. So there are some home builders out there that have stopped taking contracts because of the increase in supplies. So for buyers that signed contracts several months ago at a, you know, a fixed price, the builder is now suffering a bit of a loss because they anticipated supplies costing X, and now they're costing a little more. So that's something to think about as well. But I always say P to the fifth power is really the key. You know, prior preparation prevents poor performance. Write that down.
I'm writing it down right now. Dan, at what point is someone supposed to talk to a real estate attorney in this process? They found the home of their dreams or before they found the home of their dreams?
I think before is the best way to go, and I get both types of calls. I get calls where the seller or the buyer says, I just signed a contract. I need an attorney. Can you help me? And then we've got a couple of days called the attorney approval contingency to go through the paperwork together and explain and make sure that they know what they just signed. There are other clients that call and say, I'm thinking about buying. I'm thinking about selling. I wanted to have a conversation with you first. Can you tell me about the process, what you do during the process? And I, of course, I love both types of calls, but I think the latter call, you know, for planning purposes, is probably a bit better, so that, you know, I keep an eye out for it and that we're not under a time crunch. You know, oftentimes I get contracts, and like I said, there's this attorney approval contingency. Once that date comes and goes, it's gone if it's not extended, but I need more than a day. You know, sometimes, you know, I get the contract and the attorney approval date is that day, or if it's the following day. And in this type of market with multiple offers, we want to get the contract approved as quickly as we can. I would suggest, you know, for our listeners, if they are thinking about buying or selling, now is a great time to have a conversation.
It sounds like it, because, you know, you're so used to hearing people say that they have a real estate broker already, right? Either to help them find a home or to help them sell a home. But your part of the equation is so important. I mean, they can fall in love with the physical, but you're making sure what's under the hood is okay, and that's and you know, there isn't going to be a headache down the road. I mean, there might be not only financially. We always talk about these liens, or I know you've talked oftentimes about a mortgage that wasn't properly satisfied in the chain of title. So someone owned it, you know, one person before, they had a loan on the property, and the county clerk doesn't say that that loan was ever paid off. Actually, what does that mean? And then I'll have another question for you, if you don't mind, Dan.
I don't mind at all, Dave. Yeah, I mean, oftentimes when I review a title search and I see a mortgage that's open from a prior owner from 15 years ago, it is pretty clear to me that it's paid. Otherwise, my seller client would be getting calls left and right, letters and this and that, and they're not. But oftentimes the banks slip up. You know, they're supposed to file paperwork with the county clerk releasing that lien, and everything is indexed by what's called an instrument number or a book and page number. And if someone hits the wrong digit, you know, because a human error or they're just having a bad day, that mortgage, even though it's paid and we have proof of payment, will still show up as open of record. And the seller and then their attorney have to clear it up. Many years ago, banks would send this, it's called the satisfaction of mortgage, they would send that paperwork to the borrower. And the borrower says, oh, that's great. I'll either throw this away or put it in a file and never see it again. But they didn't realize they were supposed to take it to the county clerk's office. So if that situation does come up, it's just a lot of detective work, you know, getting the right person on the phone, you know, and when dealing with, I call them the bigger banks, the national lenders, it can take a little bit more time to get to the right person and to get the paperwork corrected.
Dan, Dave, we are at the bottom of the hour. We have a caller on hold. Diane and Gilderlin will come up on the other side. We're going to take our break right here. We'll be back with the second half of the Herzog Law Firm's Estate Medicaid Planning Hour coming up right after this.
You've been listening to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
Join us every week to learn more about protecting the assets you've worked hard for,
options available for Medicaid planning, and more.
With offices located in Corporate Woods in Albany,
West Harrison Street in Saratoga Springs,
Executive Woods in Clifton Park,
and Flatbush Road in Kingston,
our attorneys are here to help you.
If you'd like to schedule an appointment to speak with David,
Jane Marie Harry, or Debbie,
please call us during normal business hours, Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m.
To contact us at our Albany office, call 518-465-7581.
Our Saratoga Springs office at 518-581-8131.
Our Clifton Park office at 518-952-4010.
And our Kingston office at 845-338-6405.
Let the Herzog Law Firm help you navigate a plan that works for you and your family. Now back to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
And we're back. Good morning. My name is Dave Kabikian.
Good morning. I'm Dan Glasser.
Dan and I are two of the attorneys at Herzog Law Firm. I know we have Diane and Gilderlin on the line here. Hold on, Diane. I just want to let everyone know they can also be a caller by reaching us at 518-476-5900. That's 518-476-5900. Good morning, Gilderlin. How are you?
Very good. My question is related to, we have a large piece of property that we're getting all our eggs in a row to see if we're going to be trusting part of our estate, irrevocable, non-irrevocable. Within this piece of property, we have a cell tower. And the cell tower, we inherited the cell tower quite a few years ago. So when we make our estate out, how do we protect that cell tower? Do we put it in a trust? And also, if we do put it into the trust, I presume we cannot sell out the lease, or if we sell out the lease, that money stays in the trust. But also, how are we able to keep that income coming in so that we could use that income to support the property taxes? And what's the best way around to go around doing it? Do we have to keep it in the trust or out of the trust?
Diane and Gilderlin, thank you so much for this question. I had it in my notes to bring up something like this, so there's a lot to unpack here. We're going to unpack each of it. Dan, I hope you're as excited as I am. Okay, so
even more.
We talked right before the break about loans and satisfactions of loans and mortgages that maybe aren't recorded, or there being an outstanding lien on the property, something that comes up on the title report. There's money owed, or something like that. But the other kinds of things that can come up on the title report are things like there are easements or restrictions for how property is going to be used. There are licenses that might be associated with the property. Things like cell towers, things like signs. You know, those signs you see, those billboards, they're on someone's property, right? Someone owns property where there's a billboard on it, and they were able to build the thing, and there's all sorts of covenants and restrictions and whatever that can run with land. It could be about, you know, there's a certain portion of land that needs to stay forever wild, and that happens a lot in new developments. So, Diane, bringing it back to your fact pattern, right, you have this cell tower. Your reception must be amazing on that property, by the way. So you're able to get money, right? It's an income-generating thing. It's not that different than having a farm that generates money, because you're making money on your land. But here, it's rather passive. You created this thing. Every now and then, people are going there and maintaining it. They have a right-of-way through your property, right, to access that tower. And this is all, you know, not because we're saying it. It's because it's written in paper. It's recorded. It's against the property. And the next owner of your property will own it subject to those very same restrictions or uses or easements or any of that stuff. Okay, so Dan's search of the property will allow this to come up. Now, we talked about trusts, right? Right now, without a trust, if you had a will, if you had a revocable trust where you and your husband are the trustee, if you had a Medicaid asset protection trust, well, you know, it's a form of irrevocable trust. We talk about it all the time. Any of those options, you will still continue to be the income beneficiary of the trust. So if you put something that makes money into the trust, you, the person, will continue to see the benefit of that money, whether it's a rental property, whether it's stocks that have dividends and interest, and CDs that have interest. So in your case, it's this license that someone has, this easement someone has to use your property, and you're getting income from it. You will continue to report the income, even if it's owned by the trust. Okay? So you're going to be the income beneficiary still. That's good news. The next set of good news is if one day you do sell this piece of property, the proceeds of the sale go to the seller. This is easy stuff. But the seller isn't you, right? Dan, at the closing, would make sure that all documents are not signed by you as the owner if you did a trust. It would be you as trustee of your own trust in the case of a revocable trust. If it was a Medicaid trust, it would be someone else that you've named as trustee of your trust. And as part of that closing, Dan would have all sorts of materials that he's going to have to present to the buyer to show that whoever's signing the deed actually has the authority to do it, perhaps a copy of the trust, and so on. So from a planning perspective and protecting assets perspective, the idea that the money that comes from the sale of a property will continue to stay in the trust, that's great, because the purpose of the trust was to protect assets. So we're continuing to protect the asset, and then you could pull money out later on through something called a partial revocation. So I'm thinking, Diane, that you got it made in the shade here, right? We got this piece of property. There's a tower on it that is generating some income for you. And no matter what you do, you're going to keep getting that income until you decide to sell the property, in which case you're protecting all the money. So great fact pattern.
Okay, now that income, if I went into a nursing home, the nursing home, I know I'm allowed, okay, say if my husband and I, one of us went into the income, I mean into the nursing home, I know I'm allowed approximately around, I think, $39,000 as my basis that I could live off of, mm-hmm. I presume. Can the nursing home seize that money? Because it's part of, I know it's in the trust, but can they take that income from the trust?
Very good question. So Medicaid isn't going to take anything, which I know, okay, so what's the difference? They're going to get the money. Well, taking is different than possibly being entitled to the money. And what I mean is, and what you're getting at is, so if your husband's the applicant, he needs a nursing home, he can keep $50 a month of his income. You can keep about $3,200 a month of your income. And if your income was less than $3,200 a month, we can move over from his side of the equation some money into your side of the equation to get you to that number. If you say, well, Dave, because of this wonderful license, my income's far higher than $3,200, you have a requirement if we were going to go and not do something called a spousal refusal. You would be responsible for a spend down of 25% of your extra income above $3,200. So for let's say you had $5,200 a month of income, that would mean you have $2,000 extra dollars per month. That would mean $500 of it is supposed to be used to help pay for your husband's care. But if you did something called a spousal refusal, which would be done in the moment, you would not have to contribute anything, at least initially, and the county could try to do something about that. The important part, though, is that a trust, right, if we're concerned about you or your husband, maybe we are not putting 100% of the rights to that income into one trust. Maybe we do two different trusts, one for you, one for him. Or maybe if we're worried about him, we make it so that you, in your trust, have this license, this ability to get money from the cell phone tower operator, and he's not entitled to it. So again, it's on your side of the ledger, not his. So there's ways to kind of to switch how you guys are getting the income in a way that might be most advantageous to you.
Okay. Okay.
So lots of options for you, and certainly we say this a lot, far more than what a radio show allows us to talk about.
Yes. Yeah, I understand that. Oh, that gave me some definitely more information, because before I come to you guys, I want to be prepared with my knowledge, what I have in pockets and what we could do.
I was going to say, by the time you do come to us, you're going to be taking over the radio show for us to explain to everyone else, because you're going to be so informed. I love it.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Take care, guys. Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
And we have another caller. We have Bill in Albany.
My question is, my wife and I have been married for 54 years. We separated 12 years ago. She's living in the home that we jointly own. I'm renting. If she has dementia now, if there comes a point in time where she has to go into a nursing home, what will happen to the home?
Well, I have questions. So the easiest route and the thing that most people are going to point to is that there's an exception when it comes to, look, a house is a resource. Medicaid counts it against you because you or she could sell the house with just your signature. That's kind of what they look at, right? How easy can you get something? Can you do something with just your signature? If yes, that's definitely going to be a resource of yours for purposes of Medicaid or for her application. You guys can both sign a deed to sell the home. There are exceptions to that rule. The biggest one is a spouse. And you are technically still spouses, right? Now, you're not living there. And so certainly if you called and you said, it looks like my spouse who lives in our marital home, I live in an apartment, she needs a nursing home, I would probably encourage you to maybe start using that house so we can be better suited to use that exemption to protect the money it represents. That's all, of course, assuming that you haven't done a trust or anything like that.
There's no
trust. Yeah. So as far as I know, the spousal exemption, and I'll have to double check it, but I do think you actually need to be in the house. It's not that you exist, that you actually are residing there, and that's why that house is exempt. That's not currently the fact pattern, but it certainly could very quickly become the fact pattern if need be, because that is your home.
I would have to,
as well.
I would have to be in the house before she goes into a nursing home?
At the time that we're going to say that it's exempt because there's a spouse in the house, I need to make sure there's a spouse in the house, yeah. But that's not, you move your things now, right? If you're concerned that she needs a nursing home tomorrow, we should talk tomorrow in the office or Monday, because that's a very urgent thing, and there's a lot of things we're going to have to recommend to you and get a couple more facts from you. If she's showing some signs of decline, then we want to meet as well, but maybe not as urgent, maybe later on next week or 2 weeks from now, to talk about options you guys have to proactively plan for this possibility. Is the house the right house for her? Is it too big? And do we need to look at different options there before we're going straight, from zero to nursing home? So there's a lot of different steps along the way to you know, figure out what's best for the both of you.
Okay, thank you.
And certainly, you know, if you're separated and there's a separation agreement, there might be contractual obligations that come with this property. You want to abide by those. And, you know, certainly there could be buyouts and sales and so on and so forth. But thanks so much.
No written separation agreement.
Gotcha. So for all purposes here, there is no separation other than the fact that we reside in different properties. And that's something that comes into play if we're claiming a exemption to the real estate being a resource rule. Thanks so much for your call.
Thank you.
Dan, a bunch of stuff there. I'm sorry I hogged all the air up. I have some questions for you.
Fire away.
And these are things that Diane kind of alluded to. So, yeah, you're looking for these liens on property, but you're looking for these other things too, right?
Correct, yep. So the title search would reveal covenants, easements, restrictions. For example, that cell tower, there would be something in the documents that would reflect that. So these quote unquote run with the land. So they affect me as the owner of the land right now and anyone that buys this property from me in the future. So, you know, a lot of issues I've dealt with recently with these types of things is because some homes and newer developments have restrictions on them, which buyers don't find out about until they're just about ready to close. So, for example, you can't have a certain type of fence on the property. Maybe you can't have a fence at all. Some developments have restrictions about having kids' toys visible from the street. Mm-hmm. I can't live there. You know, or you can't park in the street on certain months. You can't have a boat or a trailer parked in your yard. So these are documents that I try to obtain early in the process to make the client aware to avoid any issues down the road. But yes, that cell tower would come up in a title search.
I think, Dan, once every, say, 3 or 4 weeks, we get a call, an email, someone's got a property dispute about a shared driveway. And, yeah. You know, land gets subdivided in weird ways, and we need access points, and you know, there ends up being this shared driveway. I'm not paying for the snow removal. I want him to pay for it. Or this tree fell. Whose tree is it? And a lot of this can depend on that title search and what the actual rules are. I know all new developments, they have those types of restrictions you're talking about. Some are small, some might be big. And you got to know what you're buying, right? If you're buying a condo or a townhome, there might be some bylaws that need to be looked at, right?
Exactly. You know, and yes, there are disputes. And, you know, speaking of the Beatles, they wrote a song about this many years ago. We can work it out. And that's what people need to do oftentimes is figure out a solution. You know, I've seen a lot of situations with shared driveways. So in that example, there should be something recorded that says, among other things, you can't block it. You know, don't get in my way if I need to get in the house. There would be clauses about maintenance, you know. At certain points, it's going to have to be sealed, plowed, things like that. Certainly, it makes sense to just split it down the middle, but sometimes people don't agree with things like that.
It's hard to believe. Another part where our worlds collide, and I know you have colossal title issues, is where the person selling the house doesn't actually own the house yet. And this comes up a lot. There's a lot of, you know, language sometimes is a barrier, and it's English to English. I mean, different languages. So, for example, Dan, sometimes people will say to us that they're the executor for their mom. And the first thing we say is, I'm sorry to hear about the passing of your mom. And they're like, no, my mom is still alive. And then we're like, no, well, then you're not executor yet, because you're only executor until State of New York formally probates the will, and you are now named executor, and you have a sealed letter that says it, and et cetera, et cetera. Sometimes people say they own a house, and it turns out, well, yeah, their grandpa owned the house and grandma, and then it got passed to their parents, and now they're the only sibling that's living there, but they have other siblings who are not there. But there was never a probate. There was never anything, and it turns out that that person doesn't have the authority to sign to sell something because of this title search showing, you know, there was never actually a deed from grandpa to anybody. I bet you see that a lot.
That's a good bet. Yeah, you would win. That does happen a lot.
What do you do?
Try to fix it. You know, what do we need to do to get to a point where you can sell it, get all the right people involved, and try to get it done.
I mean, it might mean, Dan, we're doing some estate administration and going back and trying to figure out, you know, who died when and come up with a couple. I assume there would be just a couple deeds that would be put together to connect the dots.
Right.
Or are there title companies that say, all right, we've seen enough. We understand all these death certificates and birth records, and we don't need all, you know, you don't need to go through court. Are there title companies that actually will still allow it? If they're satisfied with all those death certificates, or are they going to make everyone dot every I?
No, I mean, at the end of the day, it's a risk assessment. So the title underwriter would want to make sure that, you know, what's the risk of someone coming back, you know, years from now and filing any type of claim. Of course, the title underwriter doesn't want that, nor do we. So if I, you know, we're what's called examining counsel for a title underwriter. If there are any questions or concerns that I have when reviewing a search, I reach out to them. And if there's something that's gray and they say, and they give me the green light, yes, you can close, you know, proceed to closing. I have to print that out for the file. So if, you know, something does come up 10 years from now, well, there it is, you know, you authorized me to proceed. You know, stuff happens, yes, but we try to, you know, keep the risk low and keep everyone happy.
Dave, Dan, we have another caller. Yeah. We have Debbie in Colony.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, Colony. How are you?
I have a question about power of attorney. I heard that they're changing the law, and I want to know if I should update my document.
How long ago did you do your current power of attorney?
The one I have for my mother is probably maybe 5 or more years ago, but my husband and his brother just recently, maybe within a year or so, did one for their parents.
So there is this new form coming out, and you know, is it a better form than the current form? It's certainly a shorter form, and I know that you know, the other attorneys at the firm were all very happy. It's a shorter form because if someone has done a power of attorney last, you know, 11 or so years, they know it's about a 14-page document. Now, does it need to be 14? No. Should it be 2? Probably no either. Right. So this is in the middle. A much shorter document. They eliminated something called a statutory gifts rider from the equation that saved a bunch of pages. Still have some similar disclosures within the regular form of the power of attorney, but it's a little easier to understand. In terms of your question, do I need a new one? Need is the important part of that question, because the whole purpose of the power of attorney is, whether it's some, you know, paying a bill, or whether it's a real estate transaction with Dan through power of attorney, which happens quite often, we need to make sure it's going to work, we need to, you know, like if someone goes to the bank with a power of attorney to do something for you, the answer can't be, okay, we'll send it to our bank attorney, give us, you know, 5 to 7 business days to approve this. We want that approval to be instantaneous so that transactions can occur. And so the more you can, you know, conform to the form that is in play at the time, the better off you are. But this is such a new thing that I could tell you people will be fine using the power of attorney they've done over the last 10 years or so. But at some point, when this is out officially and everyone's using it more and more, there will come a time to update it along with probably your other documents, because at that point it will be, you know, 10, 15 years since you changed your estate planning documents.
Okay, so if our bank already has the document, then I've already enacted the power of attorney because I pay her bills, do I need to update the document?
Okay. You should be fine for now, and if the bank requires you to update the form, certainly, then you're going to have no choice on it. But I would expect that the existing form you have is just fine for quite a while, and then at some point, not need, but you're going to want to do the new form. By the way, the old form still, you know, there's a 2-page form. That can still work. It's just now more and more we run into trouble because people want the newer form, the longer form. A younger bank teller isn't going to be approving a 2-page power of attorney. They're going to have to send it up the chain to get approval on that. So it's always good to have the latest and greatest form, but I don't think you need to do it yet.
Okay, and would you be able to do a new form if the person has dementia or Alzheimer's?
So it depends, case by case. Just because they are diagnosed with something does not mean that they don't have the capacity to sign some of these documents. Sometimes we just need 10 good minutes from them. But, it makes it maybe a little more important that if they're okay, you get the new form done. Thanks so much for the call. Have a great week, everybody.
Thank you for listening to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm. For more information on their services, please visit herzoglaw.com. If you'd like to speak with one of their attorneys, please contact the Albany office at 518-465-7581, the Saratoga office at 518-581-8131, or their Kingston office at 845-338-6405.